This podcast contains explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. The following program presents an examination of a criminal investigation. Any individual who may have been investigated or faces criminal charges continues to be considered innocent until proven guilty.
911, what's your emergency? My granddaughter has been taken. She has been missing for a month.
Her head, it's bleeding severely. We need an ambulance.
This is Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. I'm Marcia Clark. On my A&E show, Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, we took a closer look at the murder of Jason Jam Master Jay Mizell, the pioneering DJ and a founding member of legendary hip-hop group Run-DMC. Jay was murdered, shot to death by two gunmen in his own recording studio on October 30th, 2002. Though there were witnesses present, they claimed they were unable to identify the killers. The case remains unsolved. But during my investigation of the case on my A&E show, I learned that at least two people might actually know who killed Jay. I'm hoping that bringing the case back into the public eye will persuade those people to come forward and finally bring justice to Jam Master Jay and his loved ones. Now, let's get to the facts of the case. I want to start by giving you some idea of who Jam Master Jay was. Jay's recording studio, named Studio 24/7, was in Jay's native Hollis, Queens. That's Queens, New York. He could have put it in a fancy building in Manhattan, but he wanted to stay in the neighborhood where he grew up so he could help other young artists in the area. It was important to Jay to give back to the community. People told me over and over again how generous Jay was with his time, with his help, and with his money. By all accounts, he was a big-hearted guy who was beloved by many.
Oh, Jam Master Jay is one of the seminal heroes of hip-hop music, period.
This is Matt Deal, author of Notorious COP, the inside story of the Tupac, Biggie, and Jam Master Jay investigations.
I mean, he was definitely one of the most talented DJs of all time.
A number of the artists that are popular today, artists like 50 Cent, they got their start because of Jay. So no one would have predicted the events that would unfold on October 30th, 2002. On that night, at about 6 p.m., Jay went to his studio. It was on the upper floor of the building. The security there was limited to a buzzer and an intercom at the main door, and just one camera at the top of the stairs. So if you were watching the monitor inside the studio, you'd only get a clear view of someone after they'd entered the building as they came up the stairs. The most you'd be able to see of someone who was outside at the main door would be a silhouette. Now I'm going to tell you about the players involved. Lydia High was at the studio that night. She was Jay's receptionist and sort of office manager. Also there, hanging out with Jay, was Jay's close friend, Uriel Pretty Tony Rincon. A short time after Jay arrived, his longtime business partner, Randy Allen, arrived with an aspiring rapper named Mike B. Randy Allen is Lydia's brother. Jay had come to the studio that night to work on a record for the duo Rusty Waters. That duo consisted of Randy Allen and Jay's nephew, Bo Skaggs. So just to review the family ties here. Randy Allen is Jay's longtime friend and business partner. Lydia High is Randy's sister and Jay's office manager. Bo Skaggs is Jay's nephew, and he was in the duo, Rusty Waters. Jay and Pretty Tony sat on the couch in the studio lounge and played video games. Randy Allen and the rapper, Mike B, went into the control room to listen to demos. Jay, at that time, had taken to carrying a .45 caliber pistol for protection. He had it with him that night. He took it out and put it on the table while they played video games. The gun made Lydia nervous. She asked him to put it away. Two men wearing dark clothes came in through the main door. It's not clear whether someone in Jay's studio buzzed them in. They climbed the stairs to the second floor and entered Studio 24/7. One of the men waved a gun at Lydia, who was sitting at the front desk. He told her to get on the floor. She complied. Then the other man stepped over her. At this point, the details of the witness's story start to conflict. but here's the parts they agree on. One or both of the men walked over to Jay. One of these men either hugged Jay or slapped hands with him. Seconds later, Jay said something like, "Oh shit." At that moment, one of the men pulled out a gun and fired two shots. The first shot hit Pretty Tony in the leg. The second shot hit Jay in the head. Both men ran out of the studio and down the fire escape, which led to the parking lot. Jay was slumped over on the couch, bleeding out. Jay died in the studio. After the break, the funeral of Jam Master Jay, a murky ID on the shooter, and a new angle on Jay. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. Well, ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you get, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We're back with Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. The police station was just a block away, so the cops got there fast. They found Jay dead on the couch. Randy Allen and Mike B. said they didn't see the killers. They'd been in the control room, which was walled off from the studio lounge, and they were listening to playbacks. Jay said he only went out to the lounge after he heard the shots. The way the studio was set up, if you're in the control booth, you really can't see what's going on in the lounge or the reception area. But Pretty Tony was sitting on the couch, right next to Jay. Yet, he said he didn't see their faces. He claimed he'd bent over to answer his cell phone when the killers came in. Lydia said she couldn't identify the killers either. She claimed they were wearing masks when they walked into reception. Investigators found two .40-caliber spent rounds at the scene. They seemed to be from the murder weapon. Jay had an entry wound behind his left ear and an exit wound on the right side of his face. There were gunpowder burns on his shirt, which suggested that the gun was fired at very close range, execution style. Police looked for the tape from the surveillance camera that was mounted at the top of the stairs, but they couldn't find it. Some say the cameras were broken or that there was no tape in the camera. Others say the tape of that night had been replaced with an old tape from earlier in the year. Regardless, no tape from that night was ever found. And this story is riddled with these kinds of rumors that conflict and swirl around but have never been resolved. So, I said before that it wasn't exactly clear how the killers had gotten into the building. Here's why. There was a button on the wall in the studio that could be pushed to unlock the main door to the building. But Lydia insists she never pushed that button. That wasn't the only way to get into the building, though. I mean, they might have been let in by one of the other businesses in the building, or they might have simply followed someone else in. The detectives came back 2 days after the shooting, hoping they could get someone to talk. They re-interviewed everyone who was in the studio, but no one could, or would, identify the gunman. The description the police had was so vague, it probably could have fit thousands of men, I mean, just in the Queens area. But they released it anyway. The description was 180-pound black male, 6 feet to 6 feet two in height, wearing a black hat and black sweatsuit when leaving the scene of the crime. I mean, the only distinctive thing was the hat, which, of course, can be easily taken off and thrown away. So the description was virtually useless. Jay's wake took place the following day, and thousands lined the street. It was a star-studded event with several celebrities, many from the hip-hop community. Thousands also showed up for Jay's funeral. Each of his group members, Run and DMC, spoke. DMC told the mourners not to believe negative reports in the media about his friend. He had good reason to say that, because for the next month, theories about the possible motives for Jay's murder flew back and forth. There was a rumor of a revenge killing by disgruntled rappers. Some thought it was a possible dispute over music publishing advances, or that Jay's murder might be connected to 50 Cent, who was one of Jay's protégés. DMC swatted away these rumors, saying Jay was not a thug. Jam Master Jay was a b-boy. Jam Master Jay was the embodiment of hip-hop. Hip-hop manifested was Jam Master Jay. He was never a sucker MC perpetrating a fraud. The last sentence is actually a reference to a lyric from one of the group's biggest hits, Sucker MCs. The day after Jay's funeral, mega producer and co-founder of Def Jam Recordings, Russell Simmons held a press conference and offered a $250,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and prosecution of Jay's murderer. Not long thereafter, the New York Post reported that Ronald Tenard Washington may have been a lookout for the gunman when Jay was murdered. Probably not coincidentally, Lydia High had named Tenard as one of the gunmen at one point. Right or wrong, it was a distinct possibility. Tenard was a drug dealer with a tough reputation, the kind that made him a likely suspect. So far, Tenard hasn't been charged, but more on Tenard later. This is Frank Owen, a British journalist who began following the case back in 2002.
You know, back in the day, Jay had this kind, it was part of this burglary crew in Hollis, right? So all the people that were kind of connected to the case were all part of that burglary crew, including Tenard, including Randy Allen, including Randy's brother, including a lot of the main people in the story were all part of that. And now Jay wasn't like a major part of this crew. Basically, what he did was, the other guys, they would burglarize apartments in Hollis. And if you know Hollis,
yeah,
it's next door to Jamaica, which is kind of rough, but there's a place called Jamaica Estates, which is kind of posh. So they used to go into Jamaica Estates and burglarize, you know, all this stuff. They would take whatever. And Jay would basically hide the stuff in the basement. Now, and this was unbeknown to his parents, because Jay's parents were very strict. If they found out about this, they would have been horrified, you know.
These were kids, weren't they, in high school or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were
they weren't like major criminals or something. No, these were just like little kids, you know, like
yeah,
getting the first taste of crime. But the point is all the people in that burglary crew all became suspects in the murder. So everything led back to that burglary crew.
Jay really wasn't a mastermind in that burglary crew. As you said, he was the one who like kind of stashed the stuff for them.
I guess he wasn't getting a big share of the cut, right? Because he was just storing the stuff. So he was like, yeah, I want to go out on one of the jobs, because he wanted to make a bit more money, right? So they didn't want to take him out, but eventually he persuaded them. So he goes out one night with them and they're robbing some house in Jamaica Estates. Security guard turns up, shoots at them, right? That was the last time Jay ever went out on one of those burglary crews jobs, right? Because, you know, that wasn't his, that was, so that's the tragedy of Jay. He was like on the kind of periphery of this criminal life, but he was never a real criminal. Jay kind of symbolized Hollis in a way, that kind of push-pull between respectability and the criminal street life.
Deal again.
I mean, people don't realize the casual relationships that Run DMC and pretty much anybody who came from that neighborhood had with serious career criminals. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And these are just guys from childhood.
Another name floated as a possible suspect was Curtis Schoon. Jay and Schoon had known each other for years. They grew up together in Hollis. Schoon's motive for killing Jay was supposedly money. The main source for this theory was Randy Allen, Jay's longtime business partner, the one who was in the studio on the night of the murder. He claimed Jay owed Schoon money for a drug deal gone bad. But that deal was years in the past. Jay didn't owe Schoon any money at the time of his death. And the two hadn't been in touch for years.
Schoon is like a scary guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I walked down the street with him and people would literally, you know, the crowd would part. Basically, Schoon had a beef with Jam Master Jay, like years and years before, but he didn't murder him. And it kind of made sense because, you know, why would he wait 10, 15 years to take revenge?
The police cleared Schoon. The next suspect to emerge was none other than Randy Allen, Jay's longtime business partner. Randy and Jay had known each other since they were children growing up together in Hollis. After Randy became Jay's business partner, he became increasingly financially dependent on Jay. There had been rumors that Randy had been stealing from Jay and that Jay was preparing to end their partnership. It was theorized that Randy helped set up the murder because he found out that Jay was preparing to cut him off. And many believed the two had a joint bank account and that Randy had cleaned it out right after Jay's death. What'd you think of Randy when you met him?
I thought he was a scumbag. I thought he was a weasel and a scumbag, and I think he was lying through his teeth.
What did he tell you?
Like he denied about the account and about stealing money from Jay, and he said that if Jay was alive today, he'd beat anybody up who said that about me.
I have to admit, Randy's behavior fueled the fire that had been lit under all these theories. Because the day after Jay was killed, Randy took Bo Skaggs, Jay's nephew, to New Jersey for a planned promotional appearance for their duo band Rusty Waters. Jay's mother, Connie, was furious. She ordered Randy to bring Bo back immediately, or she'd report him to the police for kidnapping. I mean, that's bizarre. The day after your business partner, longtime friend, is killed, you take off for a planned promotional appearance? And that wasn't the only reason Jay's mother was angry with Randy. She told the New York Daily News that Randy hadn't been in touch with the family after Jay's murder, and that he wasn't cooperating in the police investigation. She said, quote, "That hurts me more than words will ever say. All these years, Jay and Randy have been friends. We were all as close can be, and I haven't seen Randy since my Jason was killed. You're his friend for 20 years, and you don't want to talk to the police about what happened? You don't come to my house after he died? You want to say you don't know anything?" Unquote. I don't blame her. Like I said, Randy's behavior didn't help his cause. But at the end of the day, no proof was ever shown that Randy had raided Jay's bank account after the murder, and no evidence that he'd helped set up the murder ever surfaced. The rumors turned out to be just that. Rumors. So Randy Allen was never arrested or charged in Jay's murder.
No, I didn't believe a word he said. But I definitely didn't believe he killed him either.
As one theory after another was discarded, people continued to have suspicions about Jay's receptionist, Lydia, and her brother, Randy Allen. It just made no sense that neither one of them could identify Jay's killers. Randy was in the control booth when it happened, and Lydia was just feet away from where Jay was sitting when he was killed. The gunmen walked right past her. Anyway, aware of those suspicions, both Lydia and Randy gave an interview to New York radio station Hot 97 and denied any involvement in Jay's death. Lydia said, quote, "The individuals that came into the studio that night had masks on and put a gun to my head. They told me to lay down on the ground, and I thought I was going to die. As I laid down on the ground, I thought that was it. I have no regrets. I've known Jay all my life. He's given me so much. I've learned so much from him." Unquote. As months slipped by, the slow drip, drip, drip of information and rumors continued. The New York Post reported that Lydia had come forward and told the NYPD she would talk if they offered her protection, but that the police declined her request. So she fled the state and went into hiding. The NYPD denied the report.
Yeah, I mean, the problem in that, if we're going to pause and sort of focus on Lydia for a second, the big problem in this case, the legal authorities screwed up the entire Jam Master Jay case. Number one, they have no relationships with informants. And that's because of the police department's bad relationship with the community in Queens. Number two, they messed up a number of aspects of the investigation. They blew a lineup, and they were hard charging and aggressive in areas where they should not have been. And the third and most significant is that they did not provide security to Lydia High, who is the main witness in the case. She's the only real substantial witness. And it's like you have this beloved figure, and they won't even do it correctly. And no offense, as a DA.
Yeah.
I mean, the big revelation in our book about why that didn't happen is that they didn't feel like they had the budget.
If there's anything I really hate to hear, it's that. You have a key witness. She can solve the case for you. She's willing to talk. All she wants you to do is keep her safe. In the months after Jay's murder, a lot of Queens residents claimed they knew who killed Jay, but they were too afraid to speak up. For some reason, this caused some of them to believe the police must also know who the killer was, but that the police didn't care enough to solve the case. One resident said, quote, "Honestly, I think the police know what happened, but they just don't want to see justice done. I know who killed him because I'm in the streets. If I know, then I'm pretty sure they do too, unquote. I understand their frustration. They want the case to be solved. They want Jay's killer to be found and punished. But I talked to a lot of police officers and detectives involved in the case, and they all seemed very invested in finding Jay's killer.
You know, they complain that, oh, the cops don't do the job, but they don't help the cops. So even though this thing about the witness protection is bad, you know, five people saw this murder, you know, and only one of them cooperated. You know, you can't blame the cops if the people who actually saw the murder are not going to say what they saw, you know.
So if the streets were indeed talking, it doesn't seem like they were talking to the police.
But my sense was the NYPD did a terrible job at first, you know, and it was only when the feds got involved that it became a much more professional investigation.
Yet another suspect floated to the surface. Drug kingpin Kenneth Supreme McGriff. It was rumored that Jay and his wife Terry were involved in a love triangle with McGriff. The police looked into the story, but found no corroboration for the claim. That theory was quickly dismissed.
But, you know, this all comes down to, I think, that Jay was having serious money problems. You would think that somebody who, you know, a multi-platinum selling artist would not have to worry about money. Mm-hmm. But I know from talking to people close to him that he'd actually, he was in serious trouble with the IRS, that basically all the money he was earning was going to the IRS. And, you know, and they, you know, he had a really bad contract. I mean, Jay technically was not a member of Run DMC, you know that. Right, he was essentially like, I wouldn't call him a hired hand, but he didn't get the sort of money that, say, Run and DMC would get, you know.
A few months later, Frank Owen published a heavily sourced long-form article called The Last Days of Jam Master Jay in Playboy. Owen broke the theory that Jay was murdered over a drug dispute, largely based on his interviews with Tenard Washington and Curtis Schoon, which were on the record, but also on many other off-the-record sources. According to Tenard, Jay had a side business in which he acted as the middleman in sizable drug deals. Big-time drug dealers would front Jay the drugs, and Jay would line up the buyers and earn commission on the deals he made.
I believe that's why he decided to get involved in the drug trade, was they thought it was easy money.
But one of those deals went sour. Tenard said that in July of 2002, he and Jay went to Washington, D.C. to meet with a major drug dealer named Uncle, who was from the Midwest.
Well, that's what everybody called him, Uncle.
Uncle fronted Jay $180,000 worth of cocaine.
Jay then took that coke to Baltimore.
Jay had 7 days to line up a buyer. But this time, Jay and Tenard had trouble. More on that after the break. I'm a firm believer that learning doesn't stop after school. And I've spent my lifetime learning and loving the thrill of diving deeper into the topics that fascinate me. That's why I love the Great Courses Plus fascinating course, Real Crime Scenes, The Evidence Speaks. I mean, to me, as a prosecutor, what always fascinated me the most was the forensic evidence. That means the science of solving crimes. Shoe print evidence, fingerprint evidence, DNA, of course, that's huge now. Hair and fiber evidence is some of the most fascinating evidence that I've seen. The things that they see through that microscope are amazing. And this course will teach you about all the ways they solve crime using science. It's fantastic. This is the perfect course to get you started with Great Courses Plus. Or you can choose another one of their more than 10,000 courses. With Great Courses Plus, you'll get unlimited access to stream this and their entire library of courses. Learn from leading professors and experts about any topic that interests you. History, psychology, literature, science, even hobbies like writing and photography. And you can watch or listen at any time, from anywhere. I want you to enjoy the thrill of learning from the Great Courses Plus, too, so I've arranged a special limited-time offer for my listeners. A full free month of unlimited access to enjoy any of their lectures. But to start your free month, you have to go to my special URL. So sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/MCI. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/MCI. And we're back with Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. When we left, Jay and Tenard had been tasked with selling $180,000 of cocaine. They had a week to unload the drugs, and it wasn't looking like they'd meet their deadline.
Then Jay gave that coke to this guy. This guy ran off with the coke, Jay then says to Uncle, look, I don't have the coke. It was stolen. Uncle says, I don't care if you don't have the coke. Pay me. Jay says, I can't pay you. I don't have the money. Boom.
That's Tenard's story. Tenard said that on the afternoon of Jay's murder, Jay called and asked him to come to the studio. When Tenard arrived, Jay showed him the gun and gave him $200 to buy bullets. Jay planned to meet Uncle in Connecticut the next day, and he wanted Tenard to come along for protection. Tenard said he bought the bullets, but that as he was heading back to the studio, he saw two men, presumably the killers, going inside ahead of him. He identified them as two people he knew from Hollis. He heard three shots and then saw two men, presumably the shooters, hurry out via the fire escape at the back of the building. Tenard identified the two men to the police. But there were problems with that story.
The only thing he denies is that he was involved in setting up the murder, right? But a lot of people claim that Tenard was the one who set it up, he was the one who acted as a lookout, and he was the one who ushered in the killers. Tenard completely denies that, though every other aspect of the story he confirmed.
Tenard had previous conflicts with both of the men he identified. It was entirely possible he'd only fingered them to get revenge. And Tenard had his own case pending at the time. It was entirely possible that he identified those men in order to get a deal for himself. And on a more minor note, he was wrong about the number of shots fired. It was two shots, not three.
It's like what Curtis Schoonter said to me. You know, well, what's Jay going to do if you rip him off? What, he's going to write a song about it?
Months later, Randy Allen gave another statement to the media. He said Lydia told him that one of the gunmen had a tattoo on his neck. He also revealed that Lydia told the police Tenard was the man who held a gun to her head. Allen insisted that he'd fully cooperated with investigators. And he said he was furious that Pretty Tony refused to tell them who the shooter was. 3 weeks later, Pretty Tony Rincon responded. He said Jay had a pistol with him the night of the murder and that he placed it on the arm of the couch while they played video games. Pretty Tony said Jay knew his murderer and that, quote, had there been immediate animosity or if there was a problem, they wouldn't have been that close. Jay's gun was right there. He would have been blazing, end quote. He maintained that he never saw the man's face. Personally, I find that hard to believe.
This murder should have been the easiest murder in the world to solve.
Yep.
Well, you had 5, 6 eyewitnesses. They were friends of his, you know. You're telling me those people don't know what happened? They know what happened, right? And it was the fact that they did not cooperate with the police is the reason that this murder has remained unsolved until this day, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
At the same time, Frank, don't you think they're actually afraid? Because if they do know these characters, if they do know the gunmen, then they know that these gunmen are very dangerous people. Isn't it understandable that they would be afraid to come forward?
No, I mean, you know, let's show some courage, for God's sake. Okay, you're scared, but you know what? I mean, you should be able to overcome that, right? I mean, I know if it was my best friend who got shot like that, I would cooperate.
But then again, you're never afraid, Frank. You're somebody who just, you don't respond to danger.
Yeah, that's only because I'm stupid, right?
But shortly thereafter, Jay's case was classified as cold. However, when I was investigating this case for my A&E show, the police officers told me that NYPD had just reopened the case this past December, and they've convened a grand jury and begun issuing subpoenas. As of this moment, though, the case remains unsolved.
I was talking to my friend who's a prosecutor in the Bronx, assistant DA. You know that Tenard got moved to a minimum security prison, right? So I was talking about this to a prosecutor friend of mine. She said two things I thought were really interesting. One, she said, well, it sounds like he's cut a deal with the government and they're putting him in a minimum security in preparation for his release, when they were then putting me in witness protection. I'd always thought this case was just about Jam Master Jay. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, well, what if it isn't just about Jam Master Jay? What if this is really a RICO case, a racketeering case? And that what the people they're really after is not so much the gunman or the lookout, but the person who ordered the murder. And the person who ordered the murder, what if he'd done other murders? And what if this is part of a much wider drug conspiracy?
I investigated the Jam Master Jay case on my TV show for A&E, Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, so tune in and watch. It airs tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Standard and 8 p.m. Central on A&E, or find it online at aetv.com. And now it's time for the mailbag. We're going to answer the questions you have on the
Spreckles Mansion.
That's right. The Spreckles Mansion case, that was last week's episode, and Epi is here to be your surrogate reader.
Mm-hmm.
Go, Epi.
Once again, you guys are way smarter than I am by far, so I'm going to let you do the talking. This is from Laura. Her question is, do you believe Adam Shacknai flew in to actually comfort his brother, or could it be possible that he flew in to, quote, take care of Rebecca? Did Adam even go to the hospital that day to visit his nephew?
A great question. I don't know if he did go to the hospital or not. I don't think he could have, because by his own admission, after dinner, he and Rebecca went back to the mansion, and it was only the two of them there. So it is a question, like, why did you come there to supposedly support your brother, and then you leave him at the hospital and you go back to the house? I don't know, and it is weird.
This is from Rachel. Hi, Marcia. Although Jonah had a solid alibi for the time of Rebecca's death, if the sheriff's department does find reason to pursue Adam as Rebecca's killer, do you believe that Jonah could potentially face charges himself, either conspiracy with his brother to cause Rebecca's death, or as an accessory after the fact? So many of his actions stink of a cover-up, and excluding Rebecca from dinner that night indicates his anger at her, plus an opportunity to make arrangements with Adam. I like where you're going with this.
In my opinion, you're never going to see charges filed against Jonah. I just don't think the evidence is there. Certainly, the evidence does not show he had any foreknowledge of what his brother Adam was going to do. And this is, of course, assuming the police do put together enough of a case to file charges against Adam for the murder of Rebecca. That's a big assumption right now. It's a big if. I don't believe that there's going to ever be evidence to prove that Jonah knowingly gave support to his brother in an effort to hide what Adam had done. And that's what you would need to show to prove that he was an accessory after the fact. And I don't believe that there's ever going to be evidence of
right. Either
thing.
This is from Shay. So, was Jonah ever deposed, or did he ever make any statements in support of his brother Adam? Also, why did police or prosecutors dismiss witnesses who heard screams the night of Rebecca's death?
So, did Jonah get deposed? He did. He got deposed in the civil case. He did say that he believes Rebecca killed herself, and he doesn't believe his brother had anything to do with it, as I think he really does believe.
Okay.
I think he's... I'm just, based on what I've seen, I think that is what he believes, and so he testified truthfully.
Right. We're not in his head. What mm-hmm. do we know? So the second part of her question, why did police or prosecutors dismiss witnesses who heard screams that night?
You know, why did the police do so many things? And by the way, it's the sheriff's department, not
right. Police.
So,
right. You
know, if anybody wants to email the sheriff's department about their feeling that the case should really be reexamined, you might want to guide those emails toward the San Diego Sheriff's Department. Sheriff Bill Gore is the name, just in case. That said, I really don't know why so many things happened the way they did in this investigation. I just think that the issue of confirmation bias came into play here. You know, anything that didn't fit the theory they wanted to believe, which was that this was a suicide, was kind of dismissed or minimized in importance.
Right. So Adam Shacknai has no money. So whatever verdict is rendered in this case, I believe that it was a $5 million settlement?
Award.
Award.
The jury awarded $5 million.
So the family's not likely to receive anything. He doesn't have it.
Right.
So what's the point? Is it just to have a victory for the family,
some
measure of justice?
Yes, to give them
the
some
record?
Measure of justice. Keith just wanted to get this verdict, finding Adam liable, in order to get the sheriff's department to reopen the case and reclassify this suicide at least as an unknown. That was the whole goal. The money, no one's going to see a dime, and they know that.
Of course. Okay, so here's another question from Susan. Although it was probably done, I wondered if anyone swabbed the inside of the black gloves found at the scene. If not, I'm certain they'd yield some DNA, even if it's mitochondrial DNA.
Susan is very smart.
I know. Susan took us down a path.
Yeah, really. Talk about upping the level here.
Yeah, Susan, great courses.
Yeah. Gee. I have to say, I believe they did swab the inside of those gloves. But let's remember that the DNA tools, even back then, and it wasn't that long ago, 6 years ago, were not as good back then as they are now. And in fact, on my A&E show, I talked to one of the experts that Keith Greer used in his trial, and she said that the techniques that we have today might actually yield a profile, a DNA profile, where they couldn't have back then when they were analyzed. So it's definitely worth another look, and that's what I mean when I say I hope the Sheriff's Department really does the job and, you know, goes back and really uses the tools we have today to look at this evidence again.
Right.
Somebody's putting you out of a job again.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. It's on.
Hi, Marcia. My name's Casey. During the 911 call, does Adam really yell at her, "Are you alive?" It seems very odd and extremely aggressive the way he's acting towards what would be a dying or dead woman. Thank you so much. Really enjoy the show.
Thanks for the question, Casey. It's a great one. I so agree with you. And that question, "Are you alive?" I don't understand anybody who says that. I mean, in response to the 911 operator, you know, is she still alive? Is she still? Why would you say it that way? You know, Rebecca, you're shaking her. Rebecca, can you hear me? I mean, I can think of a million things you would say. "Are you alive?" is not one of them. It is, I know, right? I mean,
other than yelling across the yard.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it feels very staged. It feels very much like someone's trying to behave as though they don't know when they really do know that she's not alive. And again, I mean, that's why I talked to the expert that I did on my A&E show, who analyzed this 911 call and found very troubling aspects to it that just made it seem like it was all a kind of staged setup of a call.
And I know it's kind of a hassle, and we're asking you to do something more. We need you to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Go to Apple Podcasts and just hit all the right buttons. Why don't you do that before you send a tweet that you might regret? Do this first. Just buy yourself that second to think about it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to subscribe, rate, and review us. We really appreciate it. Next week, the Billionaire Boys Club.
Marcia Clark Investigates, The First 48, the podcast. Hosted by Marcia Clark. Produced by Emil Klein and Chelsea Great. Research by Robin Kiyomi. Supervising producer is Scott Brody. Executive producers are Marcia Clark, Ted Butler, and Peter Tarshis. Music is by Blake Maples.
Special thanks to Rob Wood, set decorator. He can make a good thing look bad.
We're distributed by Audioboom. The TV series Marcia Clark Investigates, The First 48 is produced by ITV and airs at 9 p.m. Thursdays on A&E. Find out more at aetv.com.
But hang on. Any information, communications, or material you submit to the Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48 podcast by email, download, telephone, or otherwise is non-confidential, and AETN is free to use and reproduce such submission freely and for any purpose. Please see the site for complete submission terms.